This Do Lectures episode features British photographer, writer, storyteller, and founder of the Legacy of War Foundation, Giles Dewley. Best known for his work documenting the human stories behind the long-term impact of war, recorded live at the Global Event in Cardigan, West Wales in 2018.
Well, first off, I just want to say it's great to be here. Somebody was asking me earlier if I get nervous doing talks. I get shit scared going to the places that I go to for opportunities like this. Storytelling is what I do. This is the payback. This is the joy. This is the pleasure I get. So thank you to everyone at Do Lectures for having me here. Two little bits of housekeeping. One is I was going to talk a little bit about my charity, which just started a couple of weeks ago. But I've been listening to the talks here, and one of the things that really, really has struck me is how often people have spoken about their own fragility. Times when things have been hard mentally, depression, and all those issues that people have gone through to achieve amazing things. So I wanted to bring that a little bit into my talk. So I'm not going to be talking about my charity today, but we're going to give a free newspaper away at the end of the talk. I'll be here for a few hours before I have to leave, but please come and chat to me about the charity and ways that we can all make a difference. Second thing, I'm going to be showing a little bit of video later on about, it was taken moments after I got injured. It's not really giving away the punchline to say that I got injured. But it's quite graphic, and I should say that when it's really hot, sometimes people feel faint watching it. So if you're feeling faint or whatever, put your hand up or don't look. I'm just saying it is graphic. I think it's important as part of the talk. It helps understand what people do go through in the countries that I travel to. But as I say, just be warned about it. But I'm going to start with a completely irrelevant story that has nothing to do with my talk. But I promised somebody the other night I would tell the tattoo story. So, as I say, it's not giving much away to say that I got injured in Afghanistan. It was in 2011. I lost both my legs and my arm to a landmine. I was picked up by an American medevac crew. I never lost my consciousness. So I remember this 20-minute journey on this helicopter to Kandahar very, very clearly, and the conversations between Phil, CJ, and me. Phil and CJ were these two very tough medics from 101st Airborne. And we had a real intimacy. It's hard to explain that relationship that was built. So I always said, if I make it, I'm going to take you guys out for a drink. So 18 months after my injury, I was well enough to go to Chicago and fulfill that promise and go out and have a few drinks. Now, we had been chatting a little bit on Facebook. I thought we were getting on quite well, but I suddenly became really nervous the night before seeing them. It felt like a blind date. I'm like, you know, I mean, I know they saved my life, but what if we don't get on? So I was, you know, like any blind date, I kind of thought, well, have a couple of whiskeys, relax. I mean, it's almost midday. So I do that, and I go to meet them in a bar. It turned out they'd been really nervous as well, which really surprised me because, you know, they saved a lot of people's lives. But for various reasons, there was a connection with my story. So they'd had a couple of drinks as well. But as soon as we see each other, it's just tears. I mean, hugs, whiskeys, tears. Hugs, tequila, I think, next. Then it was definitely whiskey, followed by tequila. Whiskey, tequila, hugs, tears. It kind of carried on that pattern for about 7 hours. I mean, I was blind drunk, really, really badly drunk. They were really drunk, and we did the obvious thing you do when you're that drunk. Let's find a tattoo parlor. So we stagger out. We're in downtown Chicago. We're kind of staggering downtown. I mean, I'm still learning to use my prosthetic legs at this stage, but I was walking better than Phil and CJ. We're bumping into everything. We finally find this tattoo parlor, glass-fronted tattoo parlor, downtown Chicago. We go in, and they wanted to get the date that they rescued me. And as I say, I didn't realize how important it was for them. I mean, I said I don't really need a visual reminder of the day. It's kind of like I know that, oh, yeah, well, oh, sure, I forgot about that. But as I say, I realized it meant something to them, so I wanted to share that. I went first. Now, as I say, I was just learning to use these prosthetic legs. Biggest nightmare is chairs with wheels, you know, like office chairs with those little wheels. They're like kryptonite to legless people. They're my complete nemesis, because you try and sit in it, and it scoots, and I'm drunk, and anyway, I'm on the floor. The tattooist is looking a bit weird and uncomfortable about this whole thing. Phil and CJ are big guys, and they're going, buddy, don't worry about it. He's like, okay. By this stage, I'm trying to get back up on the chair. I've kind of gone on the chair and off the other side. One of my prosthetic legs has come off. So now I'm pushing this chair and kind of going around in circles. but slowly moving across the room. Tattooist looking very, very, very sheepish in the corner. Phil and CJ think it's the funniest thing they've ever seen. So they're just in hysterics. They're like pointing, laughing. By this point, my other prosthetic legs come off. So you've got a guy with no legs pushing a chair around a room. And a woman walks by. And I say, this is a glass-fronted tattoo parlor. She sees a man with no legs pushing a chair around a room and two guys laughing. So she storms in, and she walks in, and she goes straight to Phil and CJ, these two big guys. And she looks at them, and she points at me, and she goes, look, this man evidently needs help. But without batting an eyelid, and in unison, Phil and CJ, they looked at this woman, and they said, ma'am, we helped him once, we're not helping him again. So I was thinking about the theme for this talk, and the phrase that came to my mind was stubbornness and fragility. My life has been a competition between the fragility of my own mind and my own stubbornness. And there's several key points in my life where those two things have fought against each other, and that really shapes my whole story. An example of the stubbornness. At 16 years old, I wanted to leave school. I was brutally unhappy in school. I've never liked being told what to do. I've never liked any kind of idea of authority. I was very, very unhappy. But there was a lot of pressure. I was the youngest of five kids. My family had given up a lot to get me what they saw as a good education. So when at 15 I said I want to leave school, there was a lot of pressure. My family was saying, no, you're going to need your A levels. And I said, I'll never need them in my life. They're like, you're 15 years old. You don't know that yet. I said, I do. I will never have a job in my life. They're kind of going, okay, I don't know if that's a good plan. But I'm going, no, I will never need them. So I go to bed, and I'd been in tears. We'd have this massive argument. And the other theme you'll hear through my story is quite often I go to bed with a kind of upset about something. I wake up with the stubbornness taking over. So I woke up the next morning. I go down to breakfast. I look at my parents and say, I've got a plan. They're kind of going, okay, what's the plan? I said, I will do my A-levels. I will study for 2 years. I will get three A's. But I will never open the results. They're like looking at me going, what? And I said, if I open the results, that means you were right. If they stay shut, then I was right. So I was prepared to do 2 years of school, which I did. I studied hard. I finished my A-levels, and I've never opened those results. It drove my parents crazy. So that's the kind of stubbornness I've always had. So at 18, when I finally was free from school, I moved to the States. I bought a van. I was trying to pursue a sports career. I was the world's worst boxer. But I thought it was great. I remember my coach saying, Giles, you take a punch really well. And then thinking about that and going, well, maybe that's not a compliment, but you know, at 18, everything sounds good. But sport was my life. But I had it was a minor car accident, but I was hit by a car and damaged my knees enough that I had to fly back to the UK. I was in hospital and I was told, you're never gonna do sport again. And suddenly at 18, this stubbornness, this kid that had done his A-levels and not opened the results, was in a hospital, and everything he dreamt of doing had been taken away. So I was incredibly angry and incredibly frustrated. And in that moment, something happened that changed my life forever. My godfather, who I was very close to, unfortunately passed away. But his wife, his widow, came to visit me. And I was in this hospital, and she bought two things that my godfather had bought the week before he died. One was an Olympus OM10 camera, and another was a book by the war photographer Don McCullen. Now, I grew up in a house. My parents weren't interested in art or the news. I had never seen photographs like Don McCullen's. These incredibly stark black and white images of the war in Vietnam, famine in Biafra, drought in Bangladesh. And I was so moved by these photographs. I used to wake up in the middle of the night and have to look at the book again. And to this day, if I shut my eyes, I can still see the original photographs I saw of Don's. And I said, there and then, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to be a photographer like Don McCullen. So I actually taught myself photography, lying in hospital bed with this little Olympus OM10. I photographed all the doctors and the nurses, my friends, the fruit bowl, you name it. I mean, I was 18 years old. I mainly photographed the nurses. but I basically, became a photographer that way and left after a few months full of good intentions to follow in the footsteps of Don McCullen. But I had a few friends that were in bands, musicians, and they said, hey, why don't you come along and photograph, you know, gigs and backstage and all the rest of it. And bit by bit, suddenly magazines then started ringing me saying, hey, do you want to go and photograph this band? And do you want to do this? And by mistake, really, I became a rock and roll photographer, a music photographer. I mean, it's quite easy to get sidetracked when you're 18, 19 years old and you're flying over to Detroit to hang out with some cool band, drinking whiskey backstage. Good intentions of going to war zones kind of go very quickly out the window. So as I say, before I knew it, I was working with the likes of The Charlatans, Oasis, Marilyn Manson, Mariah Carey, all these incredible superstars, and living what I guess was a very glamorous life. I mean, I traveled all around the world. I worked for Vogue, I worked for GQ magazine. I was making a lot of money. I was only in my mid-20s. I had a life that most people looked at and were incredibly envious of. But I didn't feel happy. And as the years went on, I felt increasingly unhappy. What I haven't spoken about is since the age of about 10 or 11, I'd suffered badly from depression. At 14, I'd been self-harming until I was about 18. From 18 onwards, I stopped self-harming and used alcohol and drugs to take the place of that. But I'd always been troubled. And in fact, the one thing that kept me going was the photography. But I kept thinking, how is it that it's not making me happy? I was doing what anyone would dream of. I remember doing a photo shoot with a big star in Hollywood. I got paid loads of money, and I went to my hotel room, and I sat there, and I cried. And I thought, I'm so unhappy, but how could this be? Because haven't I got what everybody wants? Haven't I got this incredibly cool life? And also, I was struggling with the way the women were portrayed in a lot of the magazines I worked for. When you shot for magazines like GQ, the men would always be in the suits and styled. The women, even if they just won an Oscar or published a Booker winning prize, would be in their underwear. And I was feeling really uncomfortable with that whole situation. And in fact, it came to a big rock and roll climax. There was a story that went around at the time about this rock and roll photographer who'd gone crazy in a shoot. And the story was, there was a young actress. She was kind of half-dressed, an editor of a magazine, and they were fighting over whether she was going to be topless in their shoot. And she was crying. And I remember sitting in this room and thinking, this is not why I became a photographer. And the rock and roll story is, I took all my cameras, I said, fuck it, and threw them all out the window, and they smashed in the street below. It's in the Charlotte Street Hotel in London. Well, anyone that knows me, and a few people who kind of chatted to me, knows I'm not that rock and roll. I'm more of a Radio 4 guy. I had a little hissy fit. I threw them on the bed. It's just unfortunate they bounced off the bed and out the window. So they smashed in the street. You can still find the little crack in Charlotte Street, actually, where those cameras landed. But that was really the end of my photographic career. I was probably 29 years old, and I walked away from London. I walked away from everything. And I thought I'd never take another photograph again. I moved down to Hastings on the coast. I got a job in a bar. But what happened then, and what I hadn't realized, is the only thing that had stopped my depression completely taking over was my photography. And once that was gone from my life, I had no anchor. So I drank more, I did more drugs, I got more and more depressed. I sunk into such a deep, deep depression. And then I remember distinctly one day, I said, that's it, I can't do any more. I was probably 32 years old, and I remember walking down to the beach in the middle of the night in Hastings. It was very much like a kind of Thomas Hardy thing. There was a storm going, waves coming out, the wind, very dramatic. But I remember standing by that water and thinking, that's it. And then something weird happened. Like a little safety valve in the back of my head did the one thing that would stop me killing myself that day. That moment, I called my sister. It was about 3 o'clock in the morning. And I called my sister, and she answered the phone, and she just said hello. And that was it. And I knew I couldn't do it. And I put the phone down, and I went back home. And I said to myself, you are never going to be able to make yourself happy. You have to accept that. It's never going to happen. And in many ways, from this moment on, you are dead. You could have died that day in the beach. Your life is over. But what you can do is maybe make somebody else's life better. And at that moment, I decided I would dedicate my life, if I couldn't make myself happy, to trying to make somebody else's life happy. I got a job as a care worker. I looked after somebody with autism. I then became a full-time carer for somebody with MS. And it was during that process that I realized I had one great skill, and that's photography. And I thought, what if I use the photography to try and help other people's lives? So that's what I did. Finally, about 15 years after looking at Don McCullen's book, I finally took up that challenge, and I moved to Angola, and I started to document conflicts. I was never interested in people firing guns. My work is always about civilian populations, is always about the impact of war on others. I worked in South Sudan, in Congo, Bangladesh, trying to tell the stories that we don't hear about. I hate the phrase that gets used a lot where people say, oh, Giles, he give voice to others. I don't give voice to people. They have voices. My job is to try and make sure those voices are heard. And at times, you know, the work was really, really tough and challenging. And at times, I questioned the whole purpose and the point of it. Like I say, I was trying to do it because I was thinking maybe I could make other people's lives better. But times like this, is in South Sudan. A young boy had been shot. There was a lot of fighting going on. I say, you know, we were staying at a hospital. It wasn't a hospital, it was a few mud huts in the middle of nowhere in South Sudan, being run by Médecins Sans Frontières. There was one doctor there. And as I say, the fighting was very intense, so tons of casualties, dozens being brought in at a time. This young boy was probably a soldier. He was 12 years old. He came in, he was in one mud hut on his own. And the doctor came in, Dr. Murray. He looked at the boy, kind of shook his head and left. The boy had been shot in the liver, the arm. And suddenly I was alone in that little mud hut with this dying boy. And I thought, do I take his photograph? And I thought, well, I'm here for all the right reasons. I'm here. It's important that people know what's going on. It's important that people understand. But as a human being, pointing your camera at a dying boy to take a photograph, I took two frames, put my camera down, and sat with him for the rest of the day. That evening, I sat with Dr. Murray, and I said, you know, I don't think I can ever take a photograph again. I said, I felt like a vulture in there. I felt sick. He looked at me, and he said, I understand what you're saying. He says, but he was Australian. And he explained to me, as growing up, he used to look at things like National Geographic or Sunday Papers. And he said it was looking at those stories and photographs like that, he said, that made me want to be a doctor. It was looking at photographs like that that made me want to come to South Sudan and do the work that I do. Now, I can't say it made me feel better. And to this day, I still feel sick. Sometimes I'm physically sick taking the photographs that I do. But it does reinforce a belief that I have, that each one of us has the ability to create change. Each one of us has the ability to do something. I wish I was a doctor. I wish I could save a life directly, but I'm not. I'm a storyteller. Maybe I can inspire somebody else who can save a life. And each one of us in this room can do something, can create a little ripple that maybe impacts somebody else, and somebody else can change the world. It was while doing this work, I was in Afghanistan. I was on patrol with a group of American soldiers. I was doing a story on the impact of war. As I said, I never photograph people firing guns. I think it's impossible to ever do that without glamorizing it. My work is purely about the impact of war. Unfortunately, to do that often means you're in quite dangerous places. And on this patrol, this particular day, we were ambushed. And as we were under fire, we went around a corner, and I triggered an IED. And this was the moments after.
Heard it over the radio that it was going to be a triple amputee. A triple amputee is not necessarily uncommon, but it definitely ups the oh no factor. Not many of those make it.
The casualty Phil and CJ were picking up was Giles. He'd been photographing an American unit on a dawn patrol when he stood on a Taliban IED.
I have a memory of just floating. With no sound, nothing, but this intense heat. And then a sudden impact and just landing on my side. I could see my legs had gone. I just thought that was it.
We're gonna be in the hospital in about 5 minutes, okay? Right.
You know, I've seen people with far less injuries succumbing to their injuries very quickly. And I remember just thinking in my mind at that point, I'm not fucking dying in Afghanistan.
The biggest thing was loss of blood. We needed to make sure that his body wasn't going to go too far into shock. We had to go with an interosseal device, which is, in layman's terms, it's a ballpoint pen that goes into your sternum so you can push fluids through into the bone marrow.
He just kind of like gritted down and took the first one, like a champ, really. But as soon as they started to flush, that's when the major pain. That's when he really like, he opened up his eyes, you heard him yell.
Hey, we're wheels down in 2 minutes, okay? Hang up, buddy.
And you're just thinking, I can keep alive for 10 minutes, I can keep alive for 5 minutes. That's really all I'm thinking about.
Giles was being taken to the hospital at the US military base in Kandahar.
What's your name?
Giles.
Okay.
You're a fucking hell of a fighter, you know that?
Said you're a fighter, buddy.
I'm gonna live.
Fuck yeah, you're gonna live.
Hell yeah.
Thank you, guys. Come on, buddy. We're here for you. Love you, buddy.
Just use up everything that my body had to keep focused till Kandahar. I think at that point my brain just switched off.
I was flown back to the QH hospital in Birmingham, where I spent the next 46 days in intensive care. My family was told I wasn't going to make it. I had so many internal injuries. My lungs stopped working, my kidneys stopped working, and on various occasions my heart stopped working. On two occasions my family was called in to say their final goodbyes. But miraculously, at the end of that 46 days, I was still going, and I was well enough to be moved to a high dependency unit. But that's actually when things got really hard, because for the 46 days in intensive care, it was purely about survival. Once I was in the high dependency unit, I had to start coming to terms with what had happened to me. I was told I would never walk again, that I'd probably never live independently, that I might have to spend the rest of my life on dialysis. There was no question that I would ever work again. Everything that I valued, everything that was precious to me, had been taken away in an instant. I remember 3 months after I was injured, I was well enough to be transferred into a wheelchair and taken to have a shower for the first time. It was the first time I saw myself in a mirror. I'd lost so much weight, my arms gone, my legs gone, scars across my body, scars down here where they split my chest open. And I was disgusted. I remember being repulsed at what I saw. And it was the moment that everything came crashing home and I realized my situation. And I went to bed that night and I remember thinking so clearly, I wish I'd just died in Afghanistan. I wished I'd just died on that helicopter because I could not deal with this new reality. I wasn't strong enough. I didn't want this. I wanted to be dead. But the next morning, that old stubbornness had somehow kicked back in. And I woke up the next morning with incredible clarity. And I woke up and I said to myself, this is not going to be the end. This is going to be the beginning of something much better. And I said to myself, from this moment on, I will never think about the things I can't do, but I will focus on what I can, and I will excel at those things. And I was determined that somehow I was going to come out of this a better photographer. Now, the first thing I had to deal with was how I perceived myself. As I said, I was repulsed when I saw myself in the mirror. When friends would come to visit, I would cover my arm up with a sheet. And I thought, there's only one way I can deal with this, and that is through my photography. So my friend Simon came and bussed me out of hospital, quite literally. We were pulling tubes out. And we went to his photographic studio. We might have gone via the pub, but we definitely got to a studio. And before I'd gone to Afghanistan, in fact, just the week before, I'd been in the British Museum, and I'd been looking at the kind of Roman and Greek statues. And I remember thinking about that, and thinking about, even though they're broken, even though they're missing parts, you don't notice that. You see the beauty that is still there in those statues. And I wanted to somehow replicate that. So I did this self-portrait. And this was the moment that I said to the world, I don't give a fuck what you think about me. Because inside, I'm a better person. You may look at me and you may see my disability, you may see my injuries, but inside, I'm more focused, I'm stronger, I'm a better man. And this was the moment I took full control of my life again. I went back to hospital. I spent a year there. I had 37 operations that first year. It was a long, long process. But by the end, I was able to begin rehabilitation. I went to Headley Court, where they taught me how to walk and make strange, grimacing faces. And 18 months after I was injured, for the first time, I was able to pick up a camera. And that same month, I went back to Afghanistan and finished off the assignment that I'd been doing before, because for me, that was the most important thing I could do, was literally continue on from where I had stopped that day. But when I came back, things got really difficult again. I went back to Afghanistan, I proved to everyone I could work, but I came back and no magazines, none of the charities I used to work for would call me up. Nobody was giving me work. Everybody that said, we'll support you, wasn't there, because even though I had proved I could go back, nobody really believed in me. Nobody really believed it was possible for a triple amputee to carry on working in the same way that he had. And I remember, I was in a little bedsit. I'd lost everything financially. I'd lost my home. I was single. And I would sit in this tiny bedsit thinking, this could be my life. But again, I decided the only person that could control that was me. So in 2014, I self-funded a trip to Lebanon. Now, when I'd been in hospital, about 2 weeks after I got injured, the first rumblings of the Syrian war were happening. And I remember watching on the news as I was going through my rehabilitation, and I'd watch as the war got worse, and friends who were working there would call me up and say, this is unlike anything we've ever seen. And I knew this was going to be the most important story of my career, and I would have to find a way to tell it. So even when I was in a wheelchair, I was saying to my sister how I could mount a camera, and she's saying, shut up. But I was thinking, there must be a way I can return to doing this work. By this time, I was able to walk, and for the first time, I was able to travel independently. My camera's on my back. And I went to Lebanon in 2014 to document some of Syria's most vulnerable refugees, the elderly, single-parent families, and those living with disabilities. People like Khulud. Khulud had been working in her garden in Syria. She had her children with her when a sniper shot her in the back. She was paralyzed immediately from the neck down. She actually fell on top of one of her children. Her family managed to get her to hospital. They managed to get her out of Syria and into Lebanon. But when I met her, she was living in a makeshift tent in the Bekaa Valley. Imagine a woman paralyzed from the neck down, needing full-time care, living in a tent made of cardboard and bits of plastic, with just her husband, Jamal, as her full-time carer. I'd never seen anything so desperate. And I remember asking Khulud, what is your one hope? What's your one hope for the future? And she said, I just want to be a mother again. And she would describe how she would hear the kids running around outside, and if one of her kids fell over and scratched their leg, they would come in and they would pick up a hand that she couldn't feel and put it on the wound and say, make it better, mummy. And she said, I just want to be a mother again. On this trip, I also met Reem. Reem had been at home in Syria when a rocket hit her house. Her husband was killed in the bed next to her. She lost a leg. One of her children also died in that attack. When I met her, she was living on the top floor of an unfinished building. Because of her prosthetic leg, she couldn't get up and down the stairs. She was quite literally trapped on this rooftop. She didn't want her children with her because she felt ashamed that she couldn't look after them. The only person that lived with her was her father, Abdel. Now, most of my portraits are people looking directly at the camera. But Abdel, every time I took his photograph, he would look out to the side on this rooftop. It was kind of driving me crazy. I was like, can you look here? We're about to take the picture. And he'd look out that way. And eventually I said, look, why do you keep looking over there? And he said, Giles, you see in the distance the mountains? And I said, yes. And he said, that's Syria. Because I'm an old man. I will probably never return home. But I live on this rooftop. So the first thing I see in the morning and the last thing I see at night is my home. And on this trip, I also met a young girl called Aya. Now, I don't like to portray people as victims, victims of circumstance, but I don't like to show people as victims. With Aya, I was really struggling. Aya was just 4 years old at the time. She has spina bifida, meaning she's paralyzed from the waist down. She was living in this tent that was wet and damp and dark, and she was struggling to even sit up on the muddy floor. And I thought, if I take her photograph, she's just going to look like a victim. I can't do this. So I said to the team and the family, I said, look, I don't think I'm going to take any photographs today, but can I just spend the day and get to know you all? Well, it turned out, and this is not for the first time in my life, that Aya was completely and utterly wrong. Aya is not a victim. Aya is the feistiest four-year-old I've ever met in my life. I kind of discovered when she walked in, her sister walked in, and she looked at her sister and she said, hey, donkey, pick me up. Her sister picked her up, and we walked around the refugee camp, and basically she ran the refugee camp. Everyone's like, hey, donkey, go and do that. Donkey, do this. Everyone'd be like, yes, and they'd run off, and everybody did what Aya said. And eventually I was able to take a photograph of her that really captured her spirit. This is her playing hopscotch with her sister. Like I say, I don't like to show people as victims. If you can't work a four-year-old with spina bifida living in a refugee camp having a bad life, you don't need me. What I like to show is the true spirit of those that I photograph. So I came back from this trip, and everything changed in my life. Having gone from being in this bedsit and nobody wanting to work with me, these photographs were published, and for the first time, these photographs didn't mention my story. It was just my work. And the phone started ringing again, and people started commissioning me, and charities wanted to do projects with me. And I had my life back. And that was fantastic. I thought, this is great. And then in 2015, the UNHCR rang me up, and they said, we want to commission you to document the refugee crisis across Europe and the Middle East for a year. And this was the biggest project I've ever been given. And they gave me the greatest brief a photographer has ever been given. There's a lot of creatives in here, and I'm sure all of you will be so jealous when I tell you the brief that I got. The UNHCR, they sent me one sentence, and they said, Giles, follow your heart. And that's what I did for the next year. I documented the scenes that many of us are sadly familiar with in places like Lesbos and across Europe. But I knew that if I was really going to fulfill that brief and follow my heart, I would have to go back to Lebanon, and I would have to find those families that I'd met 2 years before. So in 2016, that's what I did. I went back to Lebanon, and I tracked down the families I'd met before, people like Reem and Abdel. Now, I think it's really good if you can take photographs back. I think it's really important that the people that I document get to see what I've done. But let me tell you something. For a guy with no legs and one arm, taking a photographic print halfway around the world is a pain in the ass. So I get there, I give Abdel his photograph. He looks at it, he looks at me, and he goes, Giles, you made me look really old in this. And I was like, well, there's gratitude for you, mate. But things were kind of improving. Reem could now go up and down the stairs. She had her kids living with her. In some ways, some kind of normalcy had come back to her life. Although, of course, for a refugee family, life never returns to normal. They're stuck in a limbo, unable to work. The kids are often unable to go to school. I remember asking Reem's daughter here, Sarah, like, what's your favorite subject at school? Tell me about your friends. And she looked at me and said, I have no friends. I can't go to school. And like a mother, she's trapped on that rooftop, a life stuck in limbo. Now, of course, on this trip, I had to go and find Aya and her family. I went back. I found that they'd moved. They were living in these unfinished buildings. But Aya, she was 2 years older and more feisty than ever. This is her being pushed in her wheelchair by her brother. She is screaming, faster, donkey, faster. But again, like Reem's family, Aya's family is stuck in this limbo, unable to take Aya to hospital, for example, when she's ill. The kids, again, can't go to school. Her family can't work to even support them beyond the pittance they get from the UN. Now, I said on this trip that I managed to track down most of the families that I'd met 2 years before. But of course, it wasn't possible to find everybody. Some had moved back to Syria. Some had moved to different places. But on the last day I was there, I got a phone call. And it was from Jamal, Khalud's husband. Khalud, the woman who had been paralyzed by a sniper's bullet. And they said, we hear you're in Lebanon, that you're trying to track us down. We're so excited, we'd love to see you again. And I remember saying, well, where are you? Of course, I can't wait to see you. I can delay my flight, I'll come and see you. Where are you? And they said, we're in the same place you last saw us. And I remember I felt like I'd been punched in the stomach. I felt physically sick. I repeated my question. I said, where are you? And they said, we're in the same place. And I remember I started crying and I thought, how could that be possible? I thought I'd done the right thing. I thought I'd told their story. Of all the people I'd ever met, the most desperate story. and nothing had changed. So what was the point? What was the point in me taking a photograph? What was the point in me telling them their story? I went there the next day, and I walked into their house, and I burst into tears, and I looked at Khalud, and I said, I failed you. And she's like an angel. She said to me, you never failed us. We knew you'd come back. But in my heart, I had. I said earlier that doing that first trip is when I got my life back. Khalud and Aya, when nobody else trusted me to work, they were the first people that trusted me with their stories. Khalud had given me my life back. And yet she was in exactly the same situation. I had failed her. There was only one thing I thought I could do, and that was to do more photographs and do a better job. Like I said earlier, this idea of not focusing on what I can't control, but excelling at what I could. But my heart was not fully in it. I spent a week there documenting their daily life. Now, this room is so tiny, probably from this wall to this wall. Three kids, Khalud lies in a bed. She can't move from the bed. There are no windows. She has stared at that same bit of ceiling for 2 years. It is torture. But yet, there is so much laughter and love in that house. It's one of the warmest, funniest places you can be. The love between Jamal and Khalud, the kids, there's always, I say, laughter, food, games. It's one of the most beautiful places you can be. The kids do the homework on the bed. Each day, Jamal does the physiotherapy for his wife. But on the last day, I had a dilemma. I said I'd take photographs back, that I like to return with the images that I've done of the people that I document. In my bag, I had the photograph I'd taken of Khalud and Jamal 2 years before. But I sat there, and I sat there doing this photograph, and I realized that the photograph in my bag was identical, that nothing had changed in 2 years. And I thought, how can I give them that photograph? Won't it just remind them that I'd failed? Won't it remind them that their life is stuck in this terrible, tortured limbo? But I thought I had to give it to them. So I reached into my bag, and I took this photograph out, and I handed it to Khalud and Jamal. But before I gave it to them, I said, when I took this photograph, I did not take a photograph of a refugee. I did not take a photograph of a disabled woman. I was photographing love. I was photographing a couple who are more in love with each other than anybody I've ever met in my life. And this is a photograph of love. And that's when I realized I'm not a war photographer. I document love. The love between a couple like Jamal and Khalud. The love between a mother and a daughter. The love between a grandparent and their grandchild. That is what I document. And I came back from this trip and I said to myself, it's not enough just to take photographs. I have to do more. It is not just enough to document and witness. I have to create change. So I decided I needed to set up a charity. And I spoke to a group in America, a group called Random Acts, who has a big network of people that try and make impacts every year. And I said, all I want is the chance to share this story through your network. And let's try and do a crowdfunding campaign. And I told them the story of love. We didn't talk about the war in Syria. We didn't talk about anything else. We talked about a couple and their love. And in a week, we raised $250,000. Every day I would watch as people were donating $10, $20, $30. Over 10,000 people donated $250,000. So eventually I was able, in fact, just a few months later, to return to Lebanon and rehouse Khalud and her family. In fact, we were able to do it for 5 families initially. And this was the moment that they were in their first house. They moved in. And I remember Khalud saying to me, she goes, thank you. She goes, I can be a mother again. I think back, and people say to me, you've done amazing things for these families. You've done amazing things for Khalud. And I always say, no, they did amazing things for me. I remember the guy that was stood on the beach thinking he could never make himself happy. Helping Khalud, helping Aya. I woke up one day and I realized I was happy. I realized that I no longer didn't like myself, that I was proud of myself, that I was able to have an impact. And so despite everything I have been through, despite losing my limbs, the pain that I'm still in, I can sit here in front of you and say, I'm the luckiest man in the world. I'm the happiest I've ever been in my life. I get to appreciate life more than anybody else I know. I said earlier that I think each one of us has the power to create change. Each one of us create ripples and impacts that we may never see, but we can make a difference. I'm overwhelmed by all the people I've met here. Everybody is somebody that's doing something. Everybody is somebody that's creating change. But I ask one question. Go home from this. Think about all the talks you've heard and ask yourself, is there anything more that I can do? And on Monday morning, wake up and do it. Thank you.
The Do Lectures is here to share stories of remarkable people in the hope they will inspire you to go and do amazing things too. There are over 300 talks to listen to, or, if you prefer, watch on our website, thedolectures.com. Hit the subscribe button on your favourite podcast platform to get the latest episodes when they come out. For our weekly curation of wonder and optimism, sign up to our newsletter by visiting thedolectures.com/newsletter.